Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Good morning and welcome to the programme today. Some schools say they could be forced to send children home because they can't get teachers. Evelyn O'Rourke has been finding out more. 840 Irish people are listed as missing on the Garda Pulse system. Can credit unions fill the gap left by departing banks? Minister Sean Fleming will join us on the programme. Mylene Klass recently praised her partner for having a vasectomy, but why is the procedure not used more as a method of contraception? England are through to the final 16 in the World Cup as Wales head home, and smart Christmas gifts, how to be thrifty, green and clever with your shopping this year. Lots of handy tips on the way. Our text number is 51551. You can email todaycb@rte.ie or on Twitter we are at todaywithclaire. But first, researchers are today hailing the dawn of a new era of Alzheimer's therapy following the publication of long-awaited trial data of a drug called lecanemab, which has become one of the first experimental dementia drugs that appears to slow the progression of cognitive decline. Now, the research breakthrough ends decades of failure and shows a new era of drugs to treat Alzheimer's is possible. And to talk more about this, I'm joined on the line by Professor David Robinson, who's consultant geriatrician at St James's Hospital and director of the Memory Clinic. I'm also joined by Helen Rochford Brennan, who's living with Alzheimer's and is an advocate for people living with dementia. Thank you both for joining us. And Professor Robinson, I'll start with you. There's a lot of excitement, measured excitement, I would say, about this drug. How significant do you think the results are?
Thank you for having me on. Yes, I think cautious optimism is the mood at the moment. This shows that the disease can be modified, at least, and that it seems to be possible to change the trajectory of it. So I don't think this is the magic bullet necessarily. And this is not the first of these compounds. They've been evolving with time. So I think this is the first one that's shown significant slowing of decline without the serious side effects we saw in earlier versions.
I saw a diagram on the BBC website this morning which explains very well how it works. But can you do the audio version of that? The simple explanation, David, as to how this drug is managing to slow the progression.
Yeah, so for reasons we don't understand, an abnormal protein called amyloid gets deposited in the brains in some people, and it's toxic, so the cells start to die off. What this drug does, it directs an antibody, which guides the body's immune system to mop up that amyloid that's in between the brain cells.
Okay.
And we think the earlier that that happens, probably the better for the patient, because we can catch the disease earlier and prevent more cells from dying off.
But this study did include some older patients.
Yes, it did. And that's one of the positive things. I mean, there were large numbers in the study. Age range was from 50 up to 91. The average age was 71. That's all quite positive because, you know, we have to think in the real world, would we be able to apply this drug? So those things are positive from the trial.
So what do you think the implications of this are for you in a practical sense?
Well, I think there'll be a lot more demand for assessments and for scans, for instance. In these trials, people had to be proven to have amyloid in their brain. So at the moment, there's only two ways of doing that. One is to do a lumbar puncture to have a look at the spinal fluid, and the other is to do quite specialised brain scans. So I think we'll see increased demand for those. And we'll also have to think about setting up the infrastructure to deliver these drugs. This trial was an infusion every 2 weeks with brain scans, which might have been for the purpose of research to monitor, but for brain scans, six of them over the course of 18 months.
So you wouldn't normally be testing for this protein then?
We do in certain cases, yes. But I think the fact that this is becoming a treatable disease, we would have to do it much more widely.
How quickly does this happen? How quickly would that infrastructure need to be put in place now that these results are through?
I think we'd be 3 to 5 years away from, we'd have to go through approval in both Europe and the US. and start building up the infrastructure. I'd say 2 or 3 years, I would think we'd be away from delivering it.
But if you're looking at delivery in 2 to 3 years, that infrastructure that you spoke about, the scans, the tests, the delivery methods, that work on that would need to start now.
Oh, and it has. We have, you know, we have a national dementia strategy. We've got 4 regional memory centres. We've got specialist nurses. We're recruiting all of those. We have models of care for this in, say, rheumatology or in osteoporosis and bone health, where there's, you know, infusion clinics. So it's possible, but it'll have to be ramped up because I think dementia is so prevalent, it applies to such a wider portion, particularly of older people.
Is it more prevalent now than it was when you first started in your career, would you say?
Definitely, for 2 reasons, I suppose. The population is getting older and also we're diagnosing it earlier. We're much more sensitive, I think, to memory change. We don't just put everything down to old age.
And you're also keen to talk about, while we're looking today at this potential treatment, about prevention.
Yes, I think that's one message to take away, is that, you know, apart from experimental drugs which are in development, one thing we can all do is just to stay more physically, socially, mentally active. If we stay learning across the lifespan and have novelty across the lifespan, when we're young, everything is new and our brains grow. And as we get older, we tend to do the same things over and over again. And we know that if you do all of those things, you can reduce up to 40% of your risk of late life dementia. So regardless of any, you know, drugs.
Well, reducing by 40% is hugely significant. So maybe we might just talk more about what people can do. So you're talking about keeping your brain active. So doing crosswords, learning a new language as you get older.
Yeah, well, it differs across the lifespan. So we know that education protects the person. So, and then in the midlife, blood pressure, making sure your blood pressure is controlled, checking your hearing, that's an independent risk factor for dementia in later life. And then towards older life, social isolation, depression, anxiety, all of these things have a massive impact and can increase the risk of dementia. And of course, the COVID pandemic did all of those things to everybody. So tackling those things then in later life, getting out, doing new things, going to museums, keeping the brain stimulated, those things all reduce the risk of late life dementia.
What about physical activity? How important is that?
That's also part of it, because some of this ties up with cardiovascular health. When I was younger, all of my older relatives died of strokes or heart attacks in their 60s and 70s, but we have stents and statins now to prevent that. People are living into their 80s and 90s. And a combination of Alzheimer's disease, which many of us will have at that stage in our lives, and cardiovascular disease will affect our brain function. So physical exercise is important also.
Mm-hmm. How important is it to get outdoors for that physical exercise?
I don't know if you necessarily have to be outside, but if you can combine social and physical activity, going for a walk with your friends, going for a round of golf, those sort of things tick 2 of the boxes. Mm-hmm. Do somewhere new and you've got novelty also.
So just going back then to this drug, because for years we've been looking, haven't we, at treatment. Does this completely change how Alzheimer's and dementia will be approached? Is it that big?
I don't know if it will completely change it. I think it's opening the window a crack. As I said, Dr. O'Philbin from the Alzheimer's Society said, it's not a panacea. But it proves the principle that the disease can be modified, which we didn't have before.
Okay.
So I think for a long time now, we've been trying to diagnose the disease earlier and earlier. We've been concentrating on the positive, what a person can do, all of the things that we know slow things down, like physical, social, and social engagement. I think this is definitely a new era, I suppose. It shows in principle that if we remove amyloid from a person's brain, then we can slow the cognitive decline. But we have to get the balance right now between side effects and administration. This drug was once every 2 weeks, once a fortnight, and there was some incidence of brain hemorrhage in the people who received the drug.
Well, that's quite a significant side effect then. How prevalent was that, do you know, in this study?
It wasn't very prevalent. There were symptomatic brain hemorrhages, I think, in 6 out of the almost 900 people that were administered the drug versus only 1 out of the people who were given the placebo.
Okay. David, stay with us because Helen is with us as well, as I said, Helen Rochford Brennan, who's living with Alzheimer's and is an advocate for people who are living with dementia. Helen, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. What does this news mean to you today?
Well, thank you, Claire. Thank you for inviting me. As a person with Alzheimer's, of course, I welcome any news that of development of medication that will improve my life and the life of everybody that's diagnosed with Alzheimer's across the world. However, I have to say to you, after 11 years of having the illness, that I am extremely cautious. I'm extremely cautious, and I also am concerned about side effects. I've learned through the years of being involved in research through the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland or Alzheimer's Europe that there are many things that we would like to see along with a medication. And David just talked about things that I refer to as psychosocial interventions, which are really important to me, Claire. Mm-hmm. It's important that I get out and walk the dog every day. It's important that I do brain exercises. It's important that I do advocacy work that demands that I talk to people like you and that I stay involved. And also, it's important that I have learned something new. No, I didn't learn a new language. I can tell you, but I did learn through COVID when we were so disadvantaged how to use technology and how to use, you know, one of the great things about it. So having a medicine together with psychosocial interventions could really improve my quality of life.
David, I'm sure you would agree with that, that this is only part of the solution if it goes that far.
Oh, gosh, yes. I'm actually wearing another hat. Thank you, Helen. I have to mention social prescribing. I'm the co-chair of the All-Ireland Social Prescribing Network, and social prescribing is a means for health professionals to refer to non-medical link workers who sit down with the person and connect them to community resources to improve their health and well-being. So that's exactly what Helen's talking about, and we do that for people living with dementia here in the hospital. We have a hospital-based social prescribing project.
I'm sure, David, listening to Helen, she's probably a model patient, given what she says she's doing.
She is.
Helen,
yeah,
how
engaging and learning a language. What I say to people, it should be something that you enjoy. I think there may need to be a little bit of structure to it. A person with dementia may have less initiative or maybe a bit more apathetic than before. So a little bit of structure, but something that the person enjoys would be very important. We're fortunate in that we have a couple of cognitive rehabilitation streams here. When a person is diagnosed, they're supported through that, and we can refer them to a formal program of cognitive rehabilitation. But that lasts for 6 or 8 weeks. It has mm-hmm. to become a lifestyle thing then as well, where you carry over that search for novelty and stimulation as part of your lifestyle.
Helen, how would you say you're doing overall 11 years on from your diagnosis?
How am I doing? Well, I'm actually, from a brain health point of view, I'm doing reasonably well. I had a bit of a setback 3 months ago, got a stroke. But other than that, I really do believe that we must do things for ourselves. We must always try and look to the great work that's been done through the Global Brain Health Institute here in Ireland at Trinity, promoting how we take care of our brains, promoting good health, and helping me to stay well. And so I follow most of the rules most of the time. I don't follow them all the time, Claire. Mm-hmm. I'm very human. But one of the things about this, can I just say, there's a couple of things. Can we say when we're doing clinical trials and we have trials like this, it's just 900 people? Yes, I welcome it. I'm as I said, I'm delighted. But let me just say from the patient perspective, there's a lot to be done for us. We have to have lumbar punctures. And lumbar punctures for a person with Alzheimer's can be very frightening. You know, there's scans, there's blood tests, there's a lot involved here. And I worry about somebody that comes from rural Ireland. I worry about who's going to get here from Kerry to Donegal along the western seaboard. And I've been involved here in this research. How, in any country across Europe, how do we get from rural areas to St. James's to take part in this research and to take part in taking this medication? Because there is so much involved. And the mm-hmm. second, which has been raised many times in this country, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you, is cost. Are the Department of Health ready? And I hope they're ready, and I hope that they are ready for prepared at least, or in the process of preparing and well advanced. And the last thing I want to say is that patients, we don't always understand what amyloid is. What is an amyloid? You know, when somebody talked to me about amyloid first, I had to say to them, what is it? And are you really looking in the right place? And I've seen so many times rejection of clinical trials. So this one is really popular. It's not all it should be. But we need for the discussions, it's a modest effect on the disease. And lastly, side effects of the medicines that are on the on.
Helen, I'll tell you, we're just losing your line there, and it's breaking up more and more as you continue. But I want to thank you very much for joining us. David, just finally for you, there are texters asking us as you're speaking about research at Waterford University in relation to an improved diet, particularly including fish oils. Is there hope there, or are we always going to rely on medical interventions?
No, I don't think we'll always rely on... Actually, the first thing I want to say, Helen made some very good points. We do our best jobs when we're listening to patients. She's absolutely right about what people have to go through. The National Dementia Strategy will allow for 4 centres across Ireland, 4 regional centres. So it won't all be happening in James's. It will be happening in Cork and Galway also. In terms of diet, no studies, to my knowledge, anyway, no studies have shown a definite effect from a diet. We know that a well-nourished brain should do better. And there's lots of kind of correlations between, you know, the Mediterranean diet, fish in your diet, and good brain function. I don't think any trial has shown an effect, but it makes sense intuitively.
Okay, and just finally, I know you want to pay tribute to the founder of the Mercer's Institute for Successful Aging, based in St. James's, and you work there too in your role.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, Professor Davis Coakley, who left us just a few weeks ago, one of the founders of Mercer's Institute. So I think it's a great legacy of his that we're able to continue on this work.
Thank you very much, Professor David Robinson, who's consultant geriatrician at St. James's Hospital and also director of the Memory Clinic. Now, moving on, and according to the Irish Daily Mail today, the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, is expected to tell the Health Committee this morning that the government has vastly underestimated the cost of battling COVID. His department will need, according to this report, a bailout of €1.4 billion. Also, the coalition is braced for a sharp rise in the final bill for the Children's Hospital, pressure growing on the HSE and the group overseeing the project to present the final costs to the government. Members of the Dáil's money spending watchdog, the Public Accounts Committee, have long suggested it will breach the €2 billion mark. Well, I'm joined by Sinn Féin Health spokesman David Cullinan. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Claire. Thank you.
In relation to that Children's Hospital project first, no matter what happens now, no matter what the bottom line is, that bill is going to have to be paid. Do you agree there's unlikely to be any way to rein this in, unless Sinn Féin has the answer?
Well, I can't see how we can be blamed for what happened in terms of the National Children's Hospital. It has been an absolute disaster from the very start in terms of the process that was used and the procurement process. Obviously, that's a matter for the government.
Mm-hmm. I'm not seeking to blame Sinn Féin, but I'm saying to you, is it a runaway train now in that it has to be completed no matter the cost?
Well, obviously it has to be completed, and we have almost 100,000 children on waiting lists, so of course we need a new National Children's Hospital. Part of the problem here, Claire, is we still don't have very clear timeframes on when the hospital will actually be built. Those dates keep shifting all the time, so we're now being told it will be mid-2024, but I think that's even ambitious. And obviously the cost is still in question. And what's happened over the last number of months is that the board has actually stalled or suspended all of the conciliation claims. So we have 980 claims which are still outstanding. The value of those, according to the board, is 480 million, and we have no idea how many of those claims will be judged to be in favour of the developer, what cost it will be to the state. It doesn't make sense to me, and it certainly made no sense to the Health Committee a number of weeks ago when we had the board in as to why they have stalled that process. The can has been kicked down the road. And we essentially have about €480 million of claims which have now been put on the long finger. So I think that figure of 1.7 billion possibly will hit over 2 billion because you have to build in inflation costs and construction costs, which are obviously going up. And all of that has to be managed. The board has to manage it, but there has to be political oversight as well. Mm-hmm. And if I was the minister, I certainly would be asking very serious questions as to why that whole conciliation process has been parked. And are we essentially just building up all of these additional costs which will have to be paid for at some stage in the future?
Do you have confidence in this budgetary oversight committee which is in place now? It's overseen by Robert Watt. Do you think that committee can keep the budget in check?
Well, that's the hope and the expectation. So I would very much hope that Mr. Watt would try and bring some clarity to the conciliation process. What we don't know, Claire, and what's outside of my control and possibly Mr. Watt's control is how many additional claims may also be made in addition to the 989 which are currently outstanding. Obviously, all of this has to be managed. It goes back to a very poor procurement process. This type of procurement process that was used where it was design only and it has proven to be an absolute disaster. We had a total of 1,600 claims so far. So about 500 have been settled. And as I said, there's about 989 still outstanding and possibly more to come. Yeah, so hopefully that board will be able to get to grips with this.
It would be very difficult to do that at the time. I mean, no one could have predicted how the cost of living was going to change and how products were going to increase after the pandemic and, of course, the war that Russia decided to wage on Ukraine. Those things were impossible to factor in, would you agree?
Well, I think, Claire, anyone that has watched the saga, which has been the National Children's Hospital, will know that we had very significant cost overruns long before the cost of living crisis, long before the war in Ukraine. In fact, before the last general election, it was one of those issues that really annoyed people because of the huge additional costs. And that was because of the type of procurement process that was put in place at the time. It wasn't properly costed. It suited the developer. All sorts of additional claims were then possible because of the process that was used. So this isn't necessarily about cost inflation. That's now part of it, but that's actually only a small part. The reality is that this was a project that was never properly costed, thought through in terms of the process that was used, and now we're paying the price. And the overruns, the vast majority of them anyway, and also that the majority of the 980 claims outstanding were in place and were claims made long before there was any war in the Ukraine and long before the most recent cost of living crisis.
As we mentioned, you're going to be at the committee today and Minister Donnelly is expected to seek more funding for the cost of battling COVID. The minister says original budgets were designed with the expectation that the threat of the pandemic of COVID was expected to diminish significantly during this year. And what we're hearing is that that hasn't happened.
No, and also the Health Committee, which has the Minister in before us as I speak, is gone into private session because we only received the actual briefing document which outlines the ask and the breakdown of where the underspend or maybe overspend in some areas was an hour before the committee started.
Have you seen that now?
I've only seen it, a cursory glance at it, and I haven't had a chance to go through it in detail. What I do know is that the total ask is 1.3 billion, and they say about 1.1 billion of that is for COVID expenditure. But then they say that there's an additional 600 million euro that is sought for non-COVID expenditure, so for current expenditure, so day-to-day running of the health service. And then they talk about cash reserves of about 480 million being used to make up for that. And the question has been asked, how in God's name has the HSE cash reserves of that nature? Why has it been used in this way? And then for us only to receive the actual briefing documents an hour before the committee session starts is absolutely outrageous. It's why the Health Committee is currently in private session discussing whether or not we should even proceed today, because it's no way to present to an Oireachtas committee when we're being asked to sign off on an additional spend of 1.3 billion.
Did I not read this morning, though, in the Daily Mail report that the Department of Health had predicted that they'd need this money, but the pushback came from public expenditure.
Yes, and that was something that was reported in the Sunday Business Post, if you remember, over a number of months from recordings that came from discussions that were ongoing within the department. So we've known this for some time. We've known that there was going to be a need for a supplementary estimate. So my point is, and I think it's a fair point for the Oireachtas Health Committee to make, our job is to make sure that there is full transparency and accountability. If a minister is coming before an Oireachtas committee to look for over 1.3 billion of additional spend, and that's separate from another 600 million where additional money was spent that wasn't intended for the purposes that was accounted for. But the money is going to be made up through cash reserves. And then you get all of this in a briefing document an hour before the committee starts. Is no way, in my view, to treat an Oireachtas Health Committee, but also no way to manage the spend of taxpayers' money and health spend. Because already, you know, we have a sense that the HSE is a runaway train in terms of how it spends money. We just talked about the National Children's Hospital. And unfortunately, Claire, because of the short notice, I don't have the answers to exactly where all of that overspend was.
All right,
we will get them when the minister is before us, if we indeed do deal with it today.
All right, we'll wait and see what happens over the course of the morning. David Cullinan, thank you for joining us on the programme. A quick update for you now on inflation across the euro area. We're hearing that it eased back to 10% on an annual basis last month. That's according to a flash estimate from the EU statistical agency Eurostat. That follows 17 consecutive months of increases in inflation. I see the Irish Times reporting that that may influence the ECB's decisions around interest rates. So that's one we'll watch with interest. Coming up next, though, Minister Sean Fleming on his plans to reform the credit union sector.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.